This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hey, and welcome again to another episode of Deconstructing the Myth Season 3, a season full of conversations about how to move forward with life during and after deconstruction. Well, I am so happy to have you on the show today, Frank. You are Frank Rogers Jr. You're a professor, spiritual director, speaker, retreat leader, and you are an author. You have written books like Practicing Compassion, Compassion in Practice, The Way of Jesus, The God of Shattered Glass, which is a novel, and the book we are discussing today, Cradled in the Arms of Compassion, A Spiritual Journey from Trauma to Recovery. And you focus on spirituality that is contemplative, creative, and socially liberative. You are the co-founder of the Center for Engaged Compassion. And I just want to tell you that your publisher for this book will often send me people, you know, to see if I want to read and interview them. And I had actually told him, don't send me more, send me less. Like, don't send me any for a while. I'm full of guests, but I'm still on the mailing list. So he didn't send the usual package to me. But when I read what your book was about, I actually reached back out to him and I said, actually, I think I want to squeeze one more in because this story seemed and proved to be so important. And I think especially the work I do with people who are in deconstruction, so really kind of investigating and rethinking Christian beliefs, especially evangelical Christian beliefs, even though it's a slightly different story than perhaps you went through, I feel like there is so much here that you share that is so desperately needed for anyone of any faith tradition, anyone who's really just a human, because there's just, I really was deeply touched by your book, like deeply. And I just, I don't know, I have a lot to talk to you about. But the thing that really drew me in to your book, of course, was when I read the intro to what it was about. And this is, I want my listeners to read what I, or to hear what I read. It said, you were like this once. What did you do to get better? A day out from a mental institution, a woman devastated by flashbacks and nightmares from childhood trauma poses this question to her big brother. Within a few weeks, she took her own life. This book is the answer that her brother wished he could have offered her. And I'm sorry I'm talking so much. I'm not even letting you talk yet. I just am really, like, it might make me cry because I feel like your book touches on the question of suffering, which is like kind of the human question in regard to God and in regard to a lot of people who end up saying, like, is God there? Does God love me? And it really just hits on it in the rawest way. So, whoa, what is happening to me? So enough of me. Why don't you tell us a little bit about you as a person and then tell us, you know, why you wrote this book and how it has played into your spiritual journey, because there's been a lot of work that your life has really shown, like quite a legacy of truly compassion and in the things you do, spiritual experiences of compassion. So what is my question? Who is Frank as a person, and what part did this book play in your journey?
Yeah, well, thank you, Liz. And your words touched me deeply. I tear up as you read that and then you share how it impacted you. So I'm so grateful. And I had no idea that you reached out to David to be able to squeeze me into this. So I'm really honored and grateful to be here and look forward to our conversation very much. Yeah. Like you said, I mean, I wrote this book really for my sister. I'm a sexual abuse survivor myself. And, you know, 30 years ago, I was in a mental institution. I was, you know, just harassed by rages and despairs and self-loathings. And I was cutting and I was inundated by flashbacks and nightmares that were just tearing me apart. And And I was fortunate enough to use that as an opportunity to go on a quest, really a psycho-spiritual quest, to find resources for healing, but psychological healing, just emotional healing from the trauma. But it was also very much a spiritual quest. I mean, how do we find you know, a credible sacred presence in the midst of the horrors of child abuse? And I was raised Catholic, and you know, a cradle Catholic, and really informed by various traditions, and yet you know, abuse rocks that world, you know, tremendously. And so I went on that search, and you know, my life, my whole vocation has been about that. And then, yeah, just a few years ago, you know, Linda, at the age of 49. A homemaker in the rural redwoods of Northern California, she started being inundated by nightmares and flashbacks and despairs and cutting. She was certain everybody was trying to kill her. She ended up in a mental hospital, and the only person she trusted in the world at that in that psychosis was me. And she asked me to come up, and I was with her. And yeah, and during our time together, she just asked me, "You were like this, you know?" And I was. What did you do? And, you know, I offered her what I could in the moment. I mean, she was in the hospital. All I could say was, you know, Linda, I got good help, and we're going to get you good help, and it's out there, and I'll be with you. And yeah, a few weeks later, she took her life. So yeah, this book is, I hadn't thought about writing the book of my own journey before, but she just kind of haunted me. And I said, you know, I need to do this for her. And then I need to do this for other survivors to let people know that our stories are out there, and we don't need to keep them secret out of shame. We need to bring them into the light of day and support one another on our journeys. So that's why I wrote this book.
It was a difficult read in some ways, but the thing about you not holding back in the way you did, sharing what the journey was like for you, is that there are so many unspoken things in so many of us, even if it's not a direct correlation. And I found even in myself things that I was like, oh, wow, I've never seen someone verbalize some of these fears or some of these things of, you know, am I a monster for X? You know, what is it? And I think that is something in part that also comes from, ironically, from the very Christianity, in my experience at least, that also told me, like, you're wildly welcomed here and everything. But and yet there's this also real tension of feeling like, but I'm not supposed to be that way in this place. Or like there's a weird shame dynamic that's so hard to untangle. Uh-huh. And even the opening scene in your book about having this powerful moment. And I'm not as familiar with Catholicism, so you'll have to tell me, but it was in front of Mary, correct? You had this powerful moment. Mary, and then someone abused you in there, like right after that moment. And it was this strange collision of worlds, collision of like shame and acceptance. And I thought that is such a metaphor for so many people's journey with religion and spirituality in a nutshell. Like that scene, that opening scene. And yet you found a way to push through in a different way than some, because so many people, I think, tie the image of God to the abuser. And I think in some ways you maybe did. Tell me if I'm speaking out of turn here, but there's been ways that you have changed and rethought that I just thought were really interesting and a really different take for some of my listeners, because I've had people on the show who talk about walking away from the faith entirely. And a lot of it is that question of like, God, I was abused and where were you? Mm-hmm. And so they left. Since my podcast explores faith deconstruction, and I've encountered a lot of people who leave the faith after abuse because of questions like, where was God? How could you let that happen? Your story shows a vastly different approach of pressing in instead of pulling away, which is maybe more common on my show. And so I'm curious, how would you approach those common questions of how could God let that happen? Where was God? How is suffering compatible with the good God? Let me just like throw the hardest human questions at you. but yeah, from your unique perspective.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Liz. I mean, and I resonate with everything you said in the lead up to that too, how much our institutions spiritual communities demonize so many aspects of ourselves, so we keep things in the shadows and don't tell our stories or hide aspects of ourselves. You know, we're not supposed to have bodies, we're not supposed to have certain feelings and or urges, and so we put on these facades, and all that stays in the shadows, just smolders and ends up biting us in the end. And so that was one of my commitments to this. To this book was I'm going to tell the truth, and I'm going to tell my whole truth, and here's the ugliness of it. This is what abuse did to me, and this is the horrors that I participated in, and these are the ravages within me, and but it all can be told, it all can be held with understanding and grace. So let's create a space to be able to do that. I really, really resonate with that. And then, yeah, you cut right to the heart, right? I mean, so how in the world do we understand God in the midst of this abuse and horror? And I would say that my approach is kind of both and. I mean, I do have a way of understanding the sacred, but I totally resonate with all of your listeners that say, I can't believe in a God that would allow this to happen. And so there was a lot of deconstruction that happened. And for me, I mean, there's so many pieces to this that are really important, but the very notion of a God that is all powerful and all knowing and can do whatever that God wants, whatever he wants, it's usually masculine, who could interrupt history and force his will onto something that happens for his own purposes or not for his own purposes. That notion of God is actually kind of a monstrous notion of God. One of my real insights was from Melissa Raphael, who was a post-Holocaust feminist theologian, that, in the midst of all these people asking where was God during the Holocaust, she said, well, what is the God you're looking for? Because that kind of a God sounds a lot more like Hitler, a God that can just decide to invade history or not, carry his own whims when he wants to, has his own reasons that doesn't need to disclose, and we just have to obey it and accept it. That's a horrid image of God, and that God needs to die. That God needs to crack out of our religious imagination. And for an abuse survivor, I mean, one of the things I talk about in this book is this is a decidedly personal question about where was God. I was asking it as well. And so the very notions that, well, there is a God that was out there that could have done something, but he didn't, because he has his own reasons. It's a mystery. So don't ask questions. Just trust, God lets things happen, because, we're all sinners. And so we're all part of the evil of this world, or you get to participate in the suffering of Christ. So be patient and endure it with resilience and even count it all joy. Yeah. Whose theology does that serve? I mean, for me, that serves the theology of a perpetrator. That's exactly what a perpetrator would say. Don't ask questions. Just endure it. There's a good reason for it. Some of it's your fault. You're sinful too. You're bad too. Count it all joy, but just let it happen. That's a theology that is insidious from an abuse survivor's perspective. And so a large part of my journey was that God had to die. The God I grew up with, the God that is so present in many of our religious communities, that's a false God. That is not the real God. Wow. That's where I started.
Yeah. So this God died, and what idea of God began to emerge for you?
Yeah, well, it was much more of a mystical understanding of God. And Melissa Raphael, she actually also talks about, too, that in the Jewish tradition, there's this understanding of the feminine presence of God, which is called the Shekinah. And the Shekinah is not one that has the power to alter history, but she is one that wanders with the people when they are in exile and wherever people are wounded or in suffering. She's that divine presence that is in solidarity with us, that gets our pain, that feels our sorrow, and is a companion with us in the midst of it, trying to inspire resilience and hope and patience and endurance and healing and transformation, not caving into the despair that evil and suffering can lock us into. And so that capacity, I mean, when you're suicidal, right, and ready to die, That notion that there is a sacred presence that is willing to be with you in the midst of that, that gets the horror of your desolation and is willing to companion you, and the very presence of that kind of companionship is itself restoring. It can rekindle a life spark in the midst of one who's suicidal. It can rekindle hope in the midst of one that's been violated. It can rekindle resilience in the midst of one who is defeated. That is genuine power. That's the real power, the power of compassion, as opposed to this kind of puppeteer power that we, you know, patriarchally idolize. That kind of power that can be with people in the midst of their pain and companion them into new life in the midst of it, that's extraordinary. That's the miracle power. That's the genuine power. And it's a feminine presence of the sacred that really met me in my deep, my darkest, most painful moments. That presence met me and helped me kind of restore and follow a path towards healing and wholeness.
Wow. That's so interesting, because I've had a couple guests mention this feminine aspect of God, and they would land all over kind of the faith spectrum. But I do think that there's a real hunger right now, and if for people to reclaim that part of God's nature. And it makes so much sense for you. It wasn't just a hunger. It was a lifeline, you know, and it's yeah. It's so interesting to see it actually taken to that length and see it hold fast, because I think that really mm-hmm. speaks to the validity of this hunger that we are seeing kind of across the board for people who maybe haven't experienced the same kind of pain you have, but who are also feeling like we're desperately missing something in the picture of God yeah. we're being given, in the picture of what's available to us concerning the divine. So I just think it's really interesting that you bring that up. I don't know if you've heard of David Hayward, the Naked Pastor, but he's an artist, and I actually interviewed him last week, and he speaks about the divine as well and the divine feminine within each of us, which mm-hmm, I thought that was absolutely. Really interesting. And I don't know, it's very new to me. It's very new to me in many ways, but I just think that's really interesting to see this thread. And I'm really curious for what that's going to do, especially for like the Christian tradition, because it's mm-hmm. so dominated by masculine images, mm-hmm. so dominated by that. It's just wild to me. So
yeah, and very, very sinister masculine images.
Yeah.
I mean, this judging, you know, I'm going to kill my son before I'm going to be willing to touch, you know, this soiled humanity that I find so repugnant. And I mean, what a horrid image of God and
yeah.
that we have. It's this very patriarchal image. And yeah, this alternative, I mean, that there's actually like a sacred presence that is like a womb that just holds us with care and compassion. And you know, the mystics talk about this. And those who, you know, injustice movements, who find that solidarity that helps them keep going in the midst of the injustices, you know, there is this empowering presence that is more subtle and comes from below as opposed to coming down from on high. And
yeah.
And it's incarnated in people who extend kindness to us. And when we have people that sit with us when we are hurting or extend that kind of compassion, those are little glimpses of like, yeah, that restores my spirit. That's a little glimpse of what this sacred presence is that permeates the universe.
Yeah.
That's powerful.
That is powerful. Well, and hearing you talk, I would love to hear how perhaps that image or whatever image helped you the most with shame. I so resonated actually when you spoke on shame, and my experience is nothing like yours, but thinking of shame and thinking of how it's, we are taught it's intrinsically tied to us, especially within the Christian tradition often. I was really struck by, in your book, you discuss how you thought you were having, you know, these really twisted, I don't know how you put it, maybe fantasies or something. You're like, wow, how could I think of that? How could I even think of that? And then you find out later, oh, that's actually a memory. You know, that's not me generated. And it actually made me think, so much, at least in my experience, there's been so much that I have felt so bad about, thinking that it came from me, came from my sinful nature. And there was all this shame. And I'm starting to unpack that now and think, wait, that came from this place or that came from this place. Maybe some of this is even neutral, you know, and it's just very interesting. So I'm just wondering how, if you could just tell us a little bit. I know the book is really does address so much about letting that shame go, but how does someone dealing with shame, especially from an abuse perspective, come into this place of actually being able to receive the compassion? Because I think sometimes with our head, we know it's available, but we cannot receive it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and shame, yeah, for an abuse survivor, I mean, shame is just at the core of what we live with. I mean, we feel like our very cells are soiled, right? We are just damaged goods in our tissues, you know, that our very skin has betrayed us, has been violated. It's like, you know, excrement has just seeped into us and is part of our being. And that's an intense form of shame. But I think you're right. I think we all experience shame in various ways. We don't have to be abuse survivors, but we all carry this. And maybe it's part of the legacy of living under Christian traditions. And maybe it's just ubiquitous to the human condition, but it's definitely in us all. And you know, for me, you know, there were different things that started helping. But you know, at the beginning was this just repeated affirmation that I would get from my therapist or my spiritual directors or companions who were with me that, you know, what you feel for a reason. What is happening? What you're going through? It doesn't come from some degenerate, original sinful nature. We're not born that way. I mean, we're really born. You know, I love, you know, John Philip Newell's work. I mean, we are born with original blessing. You know, you look at a newborn and just the beauty and the purity and the care and the freedom. There's nothing sinful or soiled about this baby, right? I mean, it's just this creature that. And so whatever happens to us in terms of the rages or the terrors or the despairs and all of the different things that we are shamed about, they came from somewhere. They came from suffering of some sort. We experienced pain. That is the reason for that. And so turning that corner from judging all of the things that I was experiencing that I thought was so shameful to, okay, there's a reason for all of this. And all of it is actually aching to be met and held and understood. That was a profound shift for me. That was actually a life changer. Everything that I was ashamed about is actually something in my psyche or soul that was trying to reach for wholeness or health in some way or another, trying to protect me or trying to help me survive or trying to help me see something about myself that needed some healing. That changed everything from judging that which is shameful for us to really being able to approach it with curiosity and even with compassion. And even finally the recognition that even the really destructive things that we do. I mean, I did some destructive things. I talk about that in the book and some relationships and those need to be have remorse around those. We do hurt people and that is genuine. And right alongside of the remorse is, and even that behavior came from my own suffering. Even that came from the legacies of abuse that I had, that I was trying the best that I could to navigate all of that and failed miserably in a lot of ways, but it opens the door for there could be compassion for that and healing and restoration. And so bringing all the stuff that I was ashamed about into the light of that kind of curiosity and compassion, whether it was in therapy, whether it was in prayer, in meditation, with talking about it with my friends that were companions, but that's what eventually kind of healed the shame and transformed it into you know, took the excrement and turned it into radiance and turned it into gold, as Jung would say, the alchemy and transformation of that.
Yeah, wow. That's beautiful. Well, I also really wondered if you could tell our listeners a little bit about imaginative meditation, as that did play a role in what you're talking about. And I have used meditation, but not like this. And I think the way you describe it is so powerful. So could you tell us about the role that played in your journey?
Yeah. It is kind of a different approach to meditation than we're usually taught. I mean, normally when we're taught to meditate, like centering prayer or mindfulness, you know, we're trying to let go of our emotions or let go of our thoughts or our impulses and kind of descend into that real ripple-less sea of stillness inside. And so for me, what that just became really problematic. I just wasn't able to do that. I mean, my PhD and my master's are in spirituality and spiritual formation. I was on a quest. I tried every single meditation, threw myself into all of it. But it wasn't working for me very well. And because I had such powerful emotions. I mean, my rages would just begin to erupt, and I couldn't just let them go and let them float away like a cloud on the sky. They were just too strong inside of me, or the depressions and the despairs were just too much of a grip. And so I just started to experiment and kind of accidentally stumbled upon this approach to meditation, and have since found, that people like Carl Jung would talk about this, Ignatius of Loyola, praying with images. But what I would do would instead of fighting, my rage, for example, that would just kind of be up inside of me and it wouldn't go away and just it was eruptive there, I would turn to it. Okay, all right. So I'm going to trust that this rage is here for a reason. It's trying to communicate something to me. It wants me to hear something. It's rooted in something that needs some tending, or maybe wounds that need to be healed. And so I'm going to take the U-turn and engage this rage inside of me, but to get some distance from it so it didn't just consume me from inside, I would invite it to become an image of some sort. And so my rage would become like a rabid wolf that's just, howling and biting and screaming. And I would kind of be able to recognize, okay, wow, so there's like this howling wolf, this fiend of rage inside of me. It actually helped me get a little bit calmed. It helped me ground a little bit. And so it's like contemplative practitioners could say, I could have the rage as opposed to being the rage. And so it gave me that little grounded separation from it that was enormously helpful as I was just whipped about in the winds of my inner cacophonies throughout my whole healing journey. But then beyond just being able to get an image of it so that I had a little grounded separation and awareness of it, like a mindfulness of it, but a genuine one, then I really recognize, okay, this comes from someplace. What is this rage wanting to say to me? What is it? Why is it screaming so loud? There's some goodness in it that it wants me to know, or something it's fighting for. And so I would query it with curiosity, and I would have a conversation, like Ignatius of Loyola would call a colloquy. I would just engage it, like, okay, what are you so angry about? And what's underneath this anger? And often what would emerge is, oh my gosh, this is coming from the little boy in me that is still holding all the pain of this abuse, and this rage is trying to protect me from that boy from ever being hurt again. And so I would have an image of the little boy, who's like imprisoned in the scene of abuse from his past. And when I could see this little boy, I could have compassion for this boy. It's like, oh my gosh, my heart breaks for this boy. And then I could engage in my meditation with that boy. What does he need? He just needs to be held. He needs to be protected. He needs to be taken out of that scene of abuse and brought to some sacred place where he is loved and welcomed and delighted in, and a place where any shame he's carrying could be washed away in healing waters. And so these would become like imaginative journeys that I would take with the various inner movements of my soul, helping restore them, helping integrate them, helping healing them. And that just brought tremendous consolation. It brought me back home to that grounded, integrated place. And so I continue to use this imaginative meditation. Well, I still do. The compassion work that we do now is really teaching people to have self-compassion and compassion for others through imaginative techniques like we just discussed.
Wow. Yeah. And could you share a little bit about, aside from your own trauma, how that helped you reconcile the loose ends and the pain of your sister's death, because that's how you end your book talking about you said, I believe, like, you visited the scene of her death in your mind so many times, but it ended up, well, I don't want to give it away. Can you just tell us how that played a role in you reckoning with her death as well?
Yeah, exactly. So, right. So this is technique that I learned and developed in my own personal recovery from trauma. I use it for everything. You know, anytime I've got activated around one thing or another, I would engage in this process. So yeah, when my sister took her life, I mean, I was gut-wrenched. I mean, on multiple levels. I mean, I was just floored. And the way I tended to my grief was to do the very same thing. And one of the ways that I was just floored was, you know, I was her big brother, right? I was the one she called up when she was in the mental hospital. I was the one that she looked to for help. I'm the one she called all her life when she was going through something, and would be her refuge or help her get through it. I was the one she asked, you know, how do I heal from this? And then she took her own life. It was like, I failed as a big brother. It's like, you know, I was not there for her in the way that she asked me to be. And that guilt and regret just was consuming me. And so what I had known was, okay, well, that guilt and regret, it's there for a reason, and it's wanting some attention inside of me. And so I turned inward and say, what is the essence of this guilt and this remorse? And it was just this deep sense of the ache that she was alone and I wasn't there with her in the car. And to have to imagine her being alone in that kind of despair, forsaken by God and family and loved ones alike, was like too crushing to bear. And so this guilt kind of protected me from having to go there. And so the antidote to that was, okay, well, I'm gonna imagine being with her then in her car. And so in my meditations, I would imagine just sitting right beside her and being with her in her death and helping communicate, you know, not to her literally in the historical world that she was not alone, that was her experience, but in the spirit world, it's like, I am going to be with you, Linda. I will sit right here. I will hold your death. I will mourn your grief. I will get it. I will get it enough that I'm not going to run from this. I'll sit right beside you. And that opened up an imaginative journey that was rather extraordinary. I had no idea. But in my journey, I even imagined I was with her as she actually expired and passed away. And just, I'm going to hold you right here. I'm not going to go anywhere. And as I was holding her, it was like the spirit of her emerged out of her body and kind of looked at me and said, you know, oh my gosh, you know, you really are sitting with me in my pain. You really are going to remember me and stay beside me, even in my death. You are really willing to do that. And I was like, yes, Linda, I really am willing to do that. That is how much I love you and how much I am committed to being with you. And that, like, in her spirit opened up a capacity in her that was able to even hold her own dead body in her compassion. Like, oh my gosh, you know, and she said, it hurt so much. It hurt so much what we went through. And I was like, yes, it really did. It really did. And you can remember it all. And I said, yes, I can really remember it all. And you can find life and new life even in the midst of it. Yes, Linda, I can, and you can too. And it, like, it restored her spirit in a way that I imagined her going into some of the hard places of her past in her spirit world, tending to her own wounds in extraordinary ways. And it was really out of that I said, and you know what? I'm going to show you how much I will remember you. I'm going to write this book for you. I'm going to write your story and my story together as a way of companioning you, even in the midst of the despair of suicide and abuse.
Wow, that was powerful. And again, I think that is so beautiful to me personally, because there are so many of us who come into a deconstruction or a faith shift from whatever reason. For me, it was really intellectual. What started this? And I've intellectually got to this idea sort of the original blessing you talked about, of looking at things instead of saying we are depraved and we are ultimately, you know, we are ultimately stained and that's why we do things, to in my own practice trying to say, okay, what is that trying to tell me? But then to see it taken again, like to such length, and have that idea of original blessing hold fast and have that curiosity prove to be a way through, as it has for you, it is so affirming of these things that I've gotten like a glimpse of, you know, from a completely different avenue, from the intellectual avenue. And I just find that really powerful because you've actually had to lean on it in a different way than maybe I have yet, but I'm starting to, because I don't know, that runs deep. So I just really appreciate that.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, and it really comes from, I mean, it's really this deep knowing that that there is compassion that holds everything. I mean, and for me, it's a sacred compassion. It's my understanding of God now, this sacred force field of compassionate energy that can hold anything, that can companion anything, that can have understanding for anything. And that means anything that we're feeling, anything we go through. It means even the horrors of child sexual abuse. It means even the suicide of a loved one. Nothing is exempt. Everything can be held. There's nothing too shameful, nothing too painful that cannot be companioned and met with compassion. And I mean everything. And that's just fundamental and core to my being and to my own healing journey.
Yeah. Well, and if you wouldn't mind sharing, you've had an opportunity, I guess, to experience that at a new level because your mother just passed away, who is mentioned in your book quite a bit.
Yeah. So, I mean, well, I mean, then, so just to say, yeah, my mom was the primary abuser for me and the sexual abuse. And for her, she was a sexual abuse survivor herself. Her stepfather, my step-grandfather, was a brute of a man. He was just a pedophile and a predator and abused her from the time she was like five years old till 18 when she finally got out of the house. And and what my mom, kind of what emerged out of that was a very sexually abusive and incestuous relationship with me, her oldest child. So the book is so much about how did I recover from that maternal sexual abuse from my mom. You know, in the midst of all of her denials and how infuriating and enraging it was, I actually had to stop contact with her for almost 10 years while I was in the real heart of my recovery. But we did, and then have a time where she met with me and my therapist, and for a very brief moment was able to acknowledge and recognize, yeah, what she had done, and realize how abusive it was to me. She kind of swallowed back up into, she kind of had a rather narcissistic, over the top personality, but it was there, and so we were able to have a relationship after that you know, with limits. But you know, I would see her, and I began to have compassion for her that the way she was towards me, it came from her suffering. It came from her abuse. I mean, she wasn't born that way. I mean, she was trying to survive in the only way that she knew how. And anyway, yeah. So, so she had a stroke about 6 months ago and was pretty much incapacitated. And I was with her, you know, getting her the care for all that. And with her husband, her current husband. Last week she kind of took a turn for the worse when the hospice nurse says, yeah, she only has a few hours to live. And so my wife and I drove up from Southern California to Northern California. When we got there, she was on morphine. She was unconscious. She was on high doses of morphine and Ativan. But she was totally distressed. I mean, her body, she was just grimacing and fighting and looked terrified. And the nurses couldn't understand it because she was on so much medication, her body should have relaxed by now. And what I had known, and she had always told me, was that she was terrified to die. She was absolutely terrified to die, a Catholic schoolgirl. She was terrified of going to see God on Judgment Day. She said she has so much to be ashamed about. She has no idea what God is going to do with her. And what I realized was this is the terror that she's feeling right now in the midst of this. And so I sat with her and for a while, and then other family members come. And so I went away to the hotel. And so that night I was just, woke up about, 11 o'clock, had gone to bed early, woke up about 11 o'clock. And I was just haunted by my mom. It's like her spirit was there, absolutely terrified, like screaming, please don't let me die. Don't let me go to see this God who's going to judge me. And I'm going to be so ashamed. And what I realized was I was really the only person in the world who knew all the sources of her shame. She hadn't even told her husband, about her child sexual abuse, let alone what she had done to me, and let alone her promiscuity. And I realized that it was like all of these parts of her that carried so much shame were trembling in fear and terror about going to the other side. And so I said, Mom, I look me in the eye. I will help each one of you pass. And so let me look. And so in this imaginative journey that just kind of comes, it was like the 4-year-old of her came up and who had just been, molested by her stepfather and had lost all of her childhood playfulness and what had happened to her. And I just could look at her in the eyes and says, this shame is not on you, Mom. This shame was on him. You have nothing to be ashamed about here. The shame that you are holding, we could wash it away, and let's just find sacred streams to wash that away. And look me in the eye, this little 5-year-old girl. You are going to be held in compassion. You will absolutely be held in compassion. And I kind of washed her, and then I kind of just brought her to this motherly presence that kind of came, who said, I will take her to the other side from here. And then I went up through her life. I mean, the 13-year-old in her that had been abused and was just in puberty and things that had happened then, and the 18-year-old her that became very promiscuous to be able to get out of the house to win over a man, and the part of her that slept with various men in her own attempts to kind of work out her sexuality. One by one, I just kind of did the same thing. Look me in the eye, Your shame, it comes from pain. It comes from suffering. You did not bring this on yourself. We could wash it away and you will be held with nothing, nothing but compassion. And then brought her to this motherly presence who would take her to the other side. Even to the point then, the mom of her who slept with me and did things to me that were inappropriate. It's like I could look her in the eye and say, Mom, I get it. I see your remorse. I see your heartbroken remorse. I get it. And I know it came from your suffering. It came from your pain. It's not your shame to carry anymore. Let's wash that away. You will be met with nothing but compassion. And then I brought her to that motherly presence. And after it was all done, this motherly presence looked at me and said, I will take them to the other side. You have done your work. There's nothing more for you to do. You can let it go. You are free of it. And I just let that motherly presence take all of my mom back to the other, over to the other side. And I came out of this. It was like a 3-hour meditation. It was like I looked at the clock and it was 1:50 in the morning. And we got up at 6 to go over to be with my mom to spell her husband. And the hospice nurse came and said, I don't know what happened last night, but we checked in on her at 10 and she was still grimacing. We checked in on her at 2 in the morning. She was completely at peace. She was completely at peace, and she stayed that way. And I just sat with her for about 4 or 5 hours and till about noon, and she was completely at peace. At peace. Her husband came in and said, I'd like to have some time with her. And I said, okay, my wife and I said, I just felt this need. Let's just drive 20 minutes over to Half Moon Bay, the beach. That's the last scene of my book, actually. It's the place where I let go of Linda. And we drove over there, and we were just with that energy. And while we were over there, the phone rang and her husband said, she just passed right now. And in some way, I helped her transition to the other side. And I honestly know I'm the only one that could have done that for her, because I was the only one that knew all the secrets and all the shame. And that's the power of compassionate healing that can bring us to a place where we can be that kind of a presence.
It really, man, you saw me over here like I'm a mess with my tears listening to your story. I think that also speaks so much to the capacity compassion can give, because, you know, earlier in your book, seeing you so harmed by the things done to you by her, to be at a place where you truly have the compassion. Oh my gosh, what is happening to me today? This is so powerful to me. But to see someone actually embody the compassion you're talking about, you actually displayed the capacity to enfold the very person who brought you the darkest parts of your life. I just think that is so powerful. And it's so actually what I was taught about Christ growing up, and yet didn't see displayed many times. It's just really beautiful to me. So
yeah, well, anyway, and it's very tender. This is the first time I've told this public. I mean, it just happened a few days ago, but also it's hard won, right? I mean, this was not an easy journey. I mean, I went through years and years of being absolutely enraged, but her voice would set me off in rage or self-loathing and shame. It was a long recovery journey to move from that. I mean, I don't want to sentimentalize that this is an easy journey in any way. And that's, the book is trying to describe the lengths that it takes and the various things that it takes. And the years that it can take to be able to get from that torturedness and really fractured relationship to a place of some measure of compassion, even for someone who brought us so much pain.
But it's possible. And I think that's the thing that's
possible.
So,
I mean, gosh, so it's possible.
Remarkable to see that it's so possible. I have had one really low suicidal point, and I think that would have been, you know, so many of us in that moment, the possibilities seem gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, the strength required seems impossible. It truly seems impossible to even, and to really, I really do hope people read your book, because I think you really detail the lowest points in ways that are so powerful for people who struggle with any sort of mental struggle like that, emotional, spiritual struggle, mental illness, any of, you know, abuse, clearly. But to see, like you said, to actually see how someone does grab onto the hope, the hope that's in front, and is able to grab onto the next one, and is able to find this route to this giant capacity for compassion, even for your abuser. I just think that is going to be such a practical roadmap that so many of us don't have. You know, we, especially when we are taught things like, oh, you know, just trust God in evangelicalism or in Christianity, mm-hmm. just trust God, just have faith, and it's like, some of that's not actually fully false, but it does not provide the roadmap. It just shows this destination. And I think that's what's so powerful about seeing someone's lived experience on the page and walking with that through you. So I really appreciate the bravery it took to do that and the time and effort, because I think it is going to be something that really tremendously helps. So
well, thank you, Liz. I mean, that's my deepest hope for the book is that people who've been in similar spaces or just spaces of their own, it doesn't even have to be about child abuse, but do know really hard spaces that you know, there are people who've been in spaces similar that can talk about it and name it and have found resources to genuinely heal and recover. And here are some things learned along the way that might offer a map, directions and practices to help us in the midst of that. That's exactly my hope.
Yeah, I think it really will. One final question before we tell people where they can find you. When I hear about sexual abuse so often, especially within, you know, purity culture, you know, in the area that I'm involved with, most often you hear about women being abused. And I just wanted to ask you about the uniquely male journey that has been part of your story, the uniquely male struggles you've encountered concerning sexual abuse, and perhaps, I mean, not that you have been able to be a woman and know the differences in that way, but from what you have seen, what are some things that we would do well to know about the male perspective when it comes to sexual abuse?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you're right. Most accounts of sexual abuse involves women or girls or young women, and there are very few accounts. I mean, that was another purpose for writing this book, is there's such few accounts of male sexual abuse, and particularly male sexual abuse that's coming from a mom. You know, male sexual abuse coming from priests and pedophiles in that respect, but coming from a mom. In terms of what's different or distinct, you know, I really don't know. I don't have the wisdom of what women's experiences are. They are both, I mean, they're just horrid. They're both horrid traumas to work through. I know for me that there were two pieces that were unique coming from a male perspective. And the first one was how often I would come into cultures and societies and communities that want to fetishize motherhood, and how, you know, motherhood is, you know, just this uncritically a great thing, that moms are to be celebrated and what they offer. And of course, that's true. I mean, of course, mothers are, I mean, extraordinary what moms do for us, but it's not everybody's experience. When you have a mom, you know, who from the womb, the way that she, you know, it's like the womb of our experience, you know, the very foundations that brought me into this world was itself seductive and sexually inappropriate. It's like the very foundations of you know, the container that held me was already abusing me and seducing me. That just gets into your cells in a way that the texture of this womb-like cosmos. I mean, the foundations that hold you, the maternity of our human experience itself is suspect. Itself is something to recoil from. That's primal. That's just a primal thing, and it affects then, you know, for me it affected the way I react to moms. It affected the way I reacted to my first wife when she became a mom. It affected the way that I reacted to women. That was, you know, that's just a uniquely thing about how a male child sexual abuse survivor from a mom, how they're going to approach motherhood and the momness of life is going to be seriously distorted and twisted from what we is our normal experience. That's huge. And the other piece I would say is, you know, I was also abused by the step grandfather that abused my mom. I mean, he really was a predator, and he raped me when I was young. He raped Linda when she was a child, and that was part of her trauma, of course. And as weird as it is, and I think this comes from, you know, kind of masculine culture, but when I talk to my wife, my current wife, who is beloved and is my soulmate and in every way, I shared with her about what happened to my mom very early in our relationship, and you knew she would accept that. It took me several years before I was able to tell her that I was raped by a man. Mm-hmm. For some reason, that carried more shame for me than telling her that I had been sexually abused by my mom. Mm-hmm. That what it said about my manhood, what it said about, you know, virility and sexuality, what it said. I mean, in some way, and I think it's a product of the sort of masculine culture that men grow up in. For some reason, that became more shaming, and to have to hide that behind the bravado of, you know, I'm not wounded like that, and that's huge in male culture, and it really gets in the way of our recovery from sexual abuse. Men trying to live into male stereotypes and masculine culture, not being able to admit some of the pains that we've experienced. That's another piece that was unique to my journey.
Yes, I think that's really helpful for a lot of us because, you know, like I've said, I've never considered the mother, how that would affect your look at motherhood. And I think as a mom, you know, I have experienced people saying, I mean, it's both and. You feel like you're doing a bad job, but then you hear people saying, like, you're a good mom. Like, oh, I just know you're. And it's like, you don't. That's an assumption that we make. We don't always, I don't know. I just think it's really powerful to think about it in a different way. Like, reality is nuanced.
Exactly.
And I think that's one thing being a male sexual abuse survivor really points out. Like, even this topic, we think we know, and it's still very nuanced. So I appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah.
I really do.
That's a great word. It's nuanced. That's a great word. There's layers and textures and dimensions, and we just need to hold all of it and not isolate part of it and glamorize.
Yeah. Well, Frank, for people that want to connect with you and who maybe want to, you know, find your work, where can they do that at?
Well, the best place would be the Center for Engaged Compassion.org. That's a Center for Compassion that I co-founded and co-created. So that's the website that is most easy to find me. And I'm open to emails at, you know, FROGERS, frogers@cst.edu.
Okay. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to share with us your story.
This has been such an honor. Thank you for embracing me, embracing this book, and inviting me into this space, especially when you have such a crowded schedule. But also, gosh, thank you for your heart and just taking into your heart so much my story. I just feel your care and compassion and how much you let it touch you deeply. That's a deep gift for me. So thank you for that, Liz.
If this episode was meaningful to you, please consider supporting the show at patreon.com/deconstructingthemyth so that episodes like today's keep coming.